Thanks a lot. Thanks for the invitation once more. And thanks to all of you for joining us in this exploration. We're going to be looking through Freedom from the Known. This book was put together by Mary Lutyens. It's a cut and paste job. Krishnamurti, this was at the time when Krishnamurti was creating a new foundation in England, the KFT. And he reached out to his old friend and later biographer, Mary Lutyens, to produce a book. He gave her the title, Freedom from the Known, and then gave her free rein as to what she would include in it. So she took the talks, the recordings, and maybe the transcripts of the talks from 1963 to 1967, and went through the topics, made a list of topics, and then picked up the excerpts that she found in the texts that she best thought that expressed those topics and weave them together. So this is her own order and according to her own criteria, and it's not necessarily Krishnamurti's own order. But of course, it's all Krishnamurti's words, and he approved of the book. Now, when we thought of this workshop, I had a little problem because the order that Mary Lutyens set up for this book didn't coincide exactly with my own sense of the order of Krishnamurti's teachings. Everybody creates their own order. It's always a problem of orders. So I had that issue with it, of course, and I said, I better change it. So I thought initially I will rearrange the chapters so that they fit in my order, but that would have been a bit tricky. So we decided, okay, now it's easy. We're going to do this kind of workshop. Everybody can read the book. So it's better that everybody reads it from the beginning and in the order in which the book stands. So that's why we're doing it this way, even though at times it goes against my grain, because I feel there is another order which is clearer perhaps. But anyway, we will get Krishnamurti's essential message all the same, no matter what order we put it in. I tend to think, and perhaps that's a good thought to bear in mind, that Krishnamurti's teachings anyway are like a hologram, that if you break it into lots of pieces, the piece always reflects the whole, which is a marvelous thing. So even a phrase sometimes contains the whole. It's just a matter of expanding and that phrase itself, such wisdom in it, and so wholesome that it's almost impossible to break it into pieces without getting the whole. So that's a virtue of this subject, and it saves us a lot of trouble too. But anyway, today we have the first four chapters, because there are 16 chapters. It's very simple mathematical primary school division. We have four workshops, so it's four chapters per workshop. So if you want also to just keep up with it, just read those chapters, and then we'll discuss them here. I try myself to make a bit of a summary and to sort of streamline the topics so that it gets a kind of finding some kind of coherence, some kind of connection. She did that in her own way, and I'm trying to follow her own connectedness and especially Krishnamurti's own internal sense of the order of our investigation, the order of this inward journey into ourselves. So that's what we're going to do, and I hope we can manage to be creative together. And if I can help it, I won't speak beyond 45 minutes, so that we can, because this is about us and is about the teachings, is a mirror of ourselves, and it's best to talk things over together. So basically, what I could draw from these four chapters as a kind of general thematics is that he begins, first chapter, right off, framing the whole investigation by saying that humanity has always sought to find something beyond itself, beyond thought. Something we might call a truth. At the time, he still used the word reality for that ultimate reality. Later on, in discussions with Bohm, reality became something else, became the field of thought. But here we're talking still in that way. So this is the frame. And I think that fits Krishnamurti, doesn't it? That there's that what was K's basic intent? It was not only to bring about an ordered mind, an ordered society, a good human being, just within that scope, but he felt that our scope as human beings and the scope of his teachings is essentially religious. Now, none of you probably is alarmed by that word, though most of the modern world is alarmed by such a word. And of course, we don't mean it in any traditional way, just like he did not mean it in any traditional way. So that's what he addresses right off, that his is his intent, that addressing this search of humanity that has been there for ages. He called it, in fact, at one point, the seed of a million years. So it's something that, in his understanding, is so deeply rooted in us, but has not had a chance to blossom. So the teachings are aiming at the blossoming of this seed, whatever that means. Essentially, as I see it, it's just the intent of humanity to goodness, and therefore facing what we are, how the reality we make, of course, is not good. So we have right off a fundamental challenge in us, in ourselves, and the world. He, of course, dismisses organized religion as not being the way to go. So he's wiping the map. He's wiping the slate pretty clean, no? I was saying out with organized religion. Now there's plenty of buildings still standing, but the meaning of it seems to, for him, to have gone out of it. These grand structures of belief, of authority, of tradition, of method, system, practice, discipline, morality is all gone. I'm not sure one can say that with complete certainty like he did, but it seemed, you know, I have this picture of the Christ in the Last Judgment by Michelangelo in the Vatican that is doing this. He's like, out with you. So he's doing this, he's wiping the thing and saying, this has not helped us. Okay, the intention maybe was good. Let's just grant that. We had a good intention, so we're not claiming this was an evil purpose, but this does not work. Our system of morality, our religious beliefs, the very traditions we have identified with have actually worked against goodness by dividing mankind, by dividing the human mind, and therefore destroying the quality of sensitivity, intelligence, and love, which is the wholeness we are actually aspiring to. So it becomes an internal contradiction of the religious approach itself. That's a major diagnosis, if he's correct, as to why the system needs to be denied. Anyone who really has this intent to goodness, let's call it that, has therefore to abandon any sense of belonging to any of these religious organizations and their system of belief. So he's denying that as a means of going into that world. What he says also, as you know, all the time is nobody can give you truth. The truth is not to be given. The truth is not to be found in any book, in any church, in any temple, and cannot be handed to you by anybody. He says something very beautiful, I think, in his notebook. He says, truth has no tradition. It's an extraordinary thing, no? That is, the truth is nothing from the past. The truth is where you are. And only you, he says, can find it. People can tell you, and we're going to talk about it ourselves, right? And he tells us anyway, some things. But essentially, truth is a living thing, and therefore not a matter of belief, not a matter of tradition, not a matter of knowledge. Truth, therefore, is in the actuality of living. And that's the primary challenge, that life is truth, or truth is in life. So that is, you know, he used to say these things when he was young as well. And he sort of sounded a bit hollow, like, what he's saying? Well, we all know this. But no, not quite. We don't know it. Because it is the immediacy of perception, of relationship, of action, that is truth. If there is order in that, then truth is operating. Truth seems not to operate, well, in the sense he means it, as wholeness. See, truth for him is wholeness. Truth is goodness. Truth, therefore, involves the understanding of the factors of division and their dissolution. And so he brings it down. He makes this movement from the search of mankind, the institutionalized dynamics of creating a church and all that and having these grand edifices. We've done enormous energy. We put enormous energy there. As you can see, historically, it's been tremendous. I mean, you only have to step into the Vatican to realize what an enormous amount of energy, creativity, and resources, what passion for mankind, for the other, for the sacred, was put into this building. So there's no underestimating that quality of energy. And yet, for Krishnamurti, the sacred does not lie in that direction. Beautiful as those things may be, it is in an inward direction, and it's a very private thing almost. I'm using the word cautiously. It's an intimate thing. His Lord sort of bets more on the mystical way of the inner encounter with the sacred than on the outer show of or institutionalized belief. So this is important. Now, if that is so, and one encounters oneself, therefore the encounter with oneself becomes central. We have to look to ourselves. We have to begin to learn about ourselves. So he puts self-knowledge, as you know, as the foundation of this movement to the truth. If I am full of illusion, if I am deceiving myself, how will I see anything that is true? So the key to truth lies in self-understanding, self-knowledge. He puts it there. But he says, who are you? What are you? Now he says, you are an individual. But then he says, actually, the individual, again, this works like the hologram, that each of us actually is a fragment, apparently, representing the whole of mankind. So when we're looking at ourselves and trying to understand ourselves, we're looking actually not only at the particularity of circumstance, background, and so on, physiognomy, race, you name it. We all have all these peculiarities that have, you know, accrued to us, stuck to us like barnacles to the hull of a ship. So there we go, sailing in this way. But we're looking at the very nature of humanity. That's how he takes it, as you know. The teachings say, well, we're looking at human consciousness, human experience as a universal phenomenon. That you and I, basically, as human beings, internally, however personal the experience may seem to be, is still within the domain of human experience, of universal experience. It says we have a book. I like that metaphor a lot. You and I are in the same book. Each of us, though we're reading only, seems to be reading, I'm reading only my history. But actually that history is just a chapter in the universal history, or even an expression, a reading perhaps even, of the universal history of mankind that is already written in human consciousness. Now, that is an extraordinary metaphor to be pondered over. I had this feeling even as a child that what I was going to go through in my life as a human being was the same as all my ancestors had gone through. And that shocked me, because then the question is, what does it mean to live if generation after generation we are just bound to repeat the same old pattern of experience, which actually is bound to conflict, pain and sorrow, right? See what I mean? There is a major question as to what it means to live and what does it mean to be whole. So the past comes right through, whoop. It's a great stream, the past. Consciousness is in that stream. And Krishnamurti, therefore, that's why he draws so much attention to this whole question of time. Why would he talk about time? It's 2 o'clock. Well, who cares? Right? But no, it is in this at this level of the psychological stream of the inherited experience of humanity that is already structurally embedded in our consciousness and makes us all what we are. With all our differences, that sameness remains and carries on generation after generation. Now, I find that tremendous, a tremendous indication, right? Because if we understand that we are each other, that we are humanity, that would make already a tremendous difference. Look what is going on. We are killing each other because we are not the same, right? And we can therefore alienate each other within this, the experience of humanity. That's the common experience. We're already alienated from each other as groups and individuals, and therefore conflict arises. That's a major source of conflict. If we see the sameness, then already we have a point of relationship. So that's one major thing to consider. Now, self-understanding, seeing oneself as one is, without illusion, because that's the way of truth, becomes central, right? How do we see, how do we perceive, is the key to Krishnamurti's teachings. I think probably he shouldn't have said anything else. Just say, what does it mean to see? What does it mean to listen? What does it mean, therefore, to perceive things as they are? His diagnosis essentially comes to be human beings, we are all messed up, corrupt, as he would put it, which is another word for fragmented, right? Corrompere, to break up. So we're broken up because we escape from what is. Now, is it that simple? That would sound very simple. That would make things simple. Stay with what is. Stay with what is. That's, he keeps repeating this like a mantra, no? Stay with what is. Om. Stay with what is. Now, is that so difficult? Why is it so difficult? Or is it difficult? What is deceiving us? What is moving us away from what is? He says, anything, if you want to understand your child, you can't come to it, to him or her, with an idea, an image of what you want them to be or not to be. You have to face them, right? As they are. That's the understanding. Understanding means to stand under the fact. Let the fact speak. Let your mind, therefore, be so objective that it will not deviate from it. And there, for him, is already a principle of integrity. When we understand, we perceive correctly, objectively, we understand, and then we act. That the perception, direct perception for him, intelligence, he defined intelligence once mysteriously to me at the time, as perception and action without a time interval. That when you see, you act. And that action and seeing in an immediate timeless way is the foundation of our relationship, integral relationship and freedom. Those are words, and we have to go a little bit into that because words by themselves don't mean much. But this is key. How we look, can we stay with what we are? Just to understand something, you must live with it. So to understand yourself, you must live with yourself. Now, wait a minute. Don't we live with ourselves anyway? But that's not what he means, right? We all live with ourselves, but we don't. We're escaping, it seems, from what we are. How can we do that? That's another mysterious thing. How can a human being, who's, we are all stuck in our consciousness, in our body, in our hearts, in our society, right? But we are escaping. How do you escape? Through fear. You escape also through pleasure and desire. We escape through all kinds of belief. The church has become an escape. That which is supposed to take us to truth has become away from truth, a means of escaping from truth. This is the beautiful thing about Kay. He sort of is relentless about bringing us down to the facts and cutting off all escapes. No exit. He creates a no exit for consciousness, saying, can you really stay there? Therefore, can you stay with what you are? What you are is not one thing. And you cannot see what you are if you have an image of yourself. Do I have an image of myself? And is therefore the image involving, again, a separation between that which is the observer and the observed? The image says, I should be something. Therefore, it creates a judgment. So this judgment keeps in comparison, of course. Are you measuring up? Where are we all? We're all measuring up to something, right? So you don't measure up to anything. There's nothing to measure up to. There's everything to be seen and nothing to measure up to. That's an interesting thing, because our culture is completely based on something else, right? That we have to measure up to this idea of being what the ideal represents, right? But in the process, we split ourselves. So again, this involves fragmentation, a struggle with oneself, like the morality of the church. There's the virtues and the sins, and we keep battling our whole lives against it, you know, with each other. The Ten Commandments, boy, is there a struggle. So these are all struggles. He says, but when you struggle, you're in conflict, you're separate, and therefore you are denying goodness. You are denying integrity. Stay with the fact. We don't know how it works, if the fact will really lead us to right action, because that's what we're talking about, to be so perceptive that action is correct and leaves no ashes of regret. Right? That's part of what the test of whether we are really intelligent and responsible in this world. Right? So this is where he comes to. And he says, these things don't help us. The ideal doesn't help me, because I can abandon the church and leave Christ to himself. Well, he's a good guy, by the way. But leave him. But at the end of the day, I will also have my own ideal, because the psyche has structured its own belief in itself. It has projected its own belief. I have my own church. Each of us is his own church. Consciousness is his own church in that regard, right? Sets up an image, which it then tries to approximate to as the fulfillment of its intent to wholeness. Case says there's no wholeness via the image-making process. Not your self-image, and not the image the observer invariably keeps projecting upon what is, and therefore missing what it is. It's an extraordinary thing. I find it subtle, but yet very revealing and very creative, because it opens the possibility of really not having that continuous struggle between oneself and what is, in relationship with things, with people, with ideas, with anything. Krishnamurti presents us right away with the possibility of wholeness in the most immediate way, which is the way of perception and action. That he calls relationship, that he calls life. That's why truth is life, because it's there in that non-separation from what is. That is, I mean, I like this sense of, if I can be free from all these troubles of mine, I would welcome it any day. But of something that we have to do, of course. The idea is beautiful, but it's his action, right? It's in the world of action. It's in the world of relationship. Now, when he says in these four chapters, he says basically that when you look at yourself, you begin to discover that you are conditioned. Now, I remember him saying this to us when I first arrived at Brockwood Park as a student, and I didn't quite get it. I had not really heard the word conditioning before either, and in English too. So I said, all right, what is this conditioning you're talking about? Condition, conditioning, air conditioner. What is it? So he would say, you're brought up as a Catholic. And I said, yes. So you're conditioned as a Catholic. I said, what? Wait a minute. Already a question mark. You've been influenced by all the atmosphere of the church. He says, well, I used to like it. You know, the incense, the vestments of the priests, the precise gestures, the chanting, the light filtering through the stained glass windows. Say, well, yes. The belief, some of it. The morality, oh boy, did that have an extraordinary effect upon me? And did it nearly break my psyche into two? So I could begin to see how, from our backgrounds, we're shaped or misshaped, distorted by that. And that's part of conditioning. Then Bohm was there also. So he said, you know, Bohm, conditioning means, and he went to Pavlov. Being a scientist, he brought in Pavlov's dogs. So from the church to the dogs, there we went, trying to understand ourselves. And he said, there you are. Conditioning means that you create a stimulus and an associated stimulus with a natural reaction. That's how you condition it. So you make a natural reaction dependent on an associate stimulus, and you keep repeating that pattern in a mechanical way. It can be shifted. It means that you reduce your action, your responses to a reflex system. Now, that was scary, because that suggests that conditioning makes us essentially mechanical. So it's destructive of the kind of intelligence and sensitivity that we need in order to see what is. Because conditioning means he doesn't see what is. You realize? When the dog is presented the food, salivates naturally. Next time, but every time the food is brought to the dog, they ring a bell or they turn on a light. So the dog associates the presence of food with a light or the bell. So next time, they don't bring any food, but they ring the bell and the dog still salivates. So this is what happens psychologically. We're conditioned to stimulate ourselves with associate stimulus, and therefore we react as though the thing was actually there. This is what thought creates its own reality, and therefore it goes on driven by it. Pleasure, pain, and fear psychologically are conditioned this way. They are associate stimulus that we stimuli that they that are instilled into us by our culture, by our society. And therefore, freedom is denied. Intelligence is denied. The mind, the heart, the senses become a mechanical system, a reflex system, where there is therefore no relationship inherently between living things. We become dead entities ruled by the past and its structural conditioning. We. Krishnamurti was making us, turning us, almost describing us as practically robots, which are sort of structured that way and have very little leeway, and therefore being essentially dead, they are neither intelligent, nor sensitive, nor capable of love. The dead cannot do any of those things. Well, I don't know what they can, but essentially we're dead, mechanical entities. The living qualities, the essential living qualities of wholeness, will not manifest, because conditioning itself is fragmentation, is the isolation of your own being in a past that has become self-referential. Right? You could almost define the self as that. That the self is this movement of self-referential thinking that only sees itself and reacts to what it recognizes, what is within the field of the known. You can see how the title of the book begins to come in here. Freedom from the known is freedom from the structure of conditioning of the past that has become a self-referential movement of the self. That is practically the heart of consciousness as we know it. So Krishnamurti is trying to dismantle consciousness. The old boy is entering into dangerous territory. Now, when we talk about conditioning, and this is one way of describing conditioning in basic terms, he comes upon the notion of pleasure. He starts looking at what are the factors of conditioning. And of course, conditioning mostly, as the behaviorist, you see, the school of behaviorism and psychology basically functions through reward and punishment. That's how you condition a dog to do certain things. If they do what you want, you reward them with something they like. If you they don't do what you want, you may punish them in some other way. So pain and pleasure are two fundamental factors of conditioning, right? Dr. Krishnamurti is very clear in his diagnosis that pleasure is one fundamental object of our psyche. He used to call it, even agreeing with Freud practically, by calling it the pleasure principle. That is, consciousness is driven by the pleasure principle. Now, he says, but what is, governs our lives? You can see it. I mean, if when he said this phrase, it shapes our lives, guides us from the cradle to the grave. Said, whoa, there you have another master mold of human existence, is this pursuit of pleasure that seems to be so ingrained in the very structure of consciousness, right? And it is a factor of conditioning as well, right? We go for what is pleasant and we try to avoid what is painful. That's just ingrained in us, in our animal nervous system. Krishnamurti says, but what is pleasure and what is pain? He says, you have to understand to begin with that pleasure and pain go together. Now, today, we're always trying to do split them apart, right? I want pleasure, for sure, lots of it, give it to me. And on the other hand, I want to avoid pain, please let's not have it, right? But apparently, is it true though? He says, no, you will not avoid, if you pursue pleasure, you will not avoid pain. Now, apparently, this is also physiologically so. Bohm came along again with his scientific objective knowledge and he said, well, they did an experiment on a cat. This is not dogs anymore, it's cats now. So the cats and dogs of our inquiry. He comes with it with a cat and he says, they put electrodes in his brain of this cat. The neurologists already know exactly where the pleasure center is and where the pain center are. There are centers. There are actually locations in the brain where pain and pleasure are stimulated by whatever it is. So they put the electrodes there to stimulate pleasure. So they turned the electricity a little, and the cat was happy. Then they stimulated a little more, and the cat was purring. And they did it a little more, and the cat pulled out his nails. So careful with pleasure to begin with, because the overstimulation of the pleasure center leads to violence, to rage. So voila, they are connected. That's why people love violence, because it can stimulate, overstimulate the pleasure center, according to these scientists. I used to call it David Bohm's cat. According to David Bohm's cat, it wasn't his cat. He didn't have a cat. But there was the experiment that he was referring to. So it is in the brain, and it is an animal device, and it has its own structure. But what they also noticed, these scientists, was that when the pleasure stimulation of the pleasure center went down, they noticed that the pain center had also been stimulated. So this is physiologically so, that when you stimulate the pleasure center, there is a secondary stimulation of the pain center. Right? The famous French ennui, after they made love, they were smoking a cigarette, because they in the movies, right? In the 60s movies, in Nouvelle Vague, they were always doing that because they were feeling a little depressed, right? After pleasure, they feel depressed. Now, why is that? Well, this is the answer according to the scientists, because when you have pleasure, you end up stimulating the pain center. Now, psychologically, it has also its reasons as to why pleasure and pain are closely associated, which is, what is pleasure psychologically? Now, Krishnamurti has a particular definition. For most of us, it just means it's sensation, right? I eat some sweet something and I get a pleasure from it. Or I watch a good film, or I don't know what, anything, all kinds of things. Sensation is a sensation. We recognize it as such because the pleasure registers it as such. Now, he says, actually, pleasure psychologically is the product of thought. So he takes it in that direction. He doesn't leave it at the level of sensation. So when he describes the pattern of pleasure, the structure of pleasure, pleasure has a structure, is the result of a process, is a causal system. So he says there is first perception, I see something. There is then sensation. You got a sensation. You have, it is all sensation. You look at the tree and this sensation. You look at the car, look at whatever, it's sensation. Then there is contact, perhaps. He used to like cars. So whenever he saw a good car, he got a sensation. And then he usually, even if he could, went and touched it. Or he talked about blue shirts, which he also liked. So he had his own desires for blue shirts and cars. And then there is the remembrance of that, of the sensation from the perception and the contact. And that is turned into a memory. Then thought picks that up and reproduces that pleasure, that sensation in the imagination. And then, of course, the desire, part of desire, is to wish to repeat it. So the repetition, the continuation of pleasure given of sensation by thought is desire, right? As he put it to us once in a little formula, desire, D equals sensation plus thought, S plus T. You can write that on any blackboard and I think it will stand scrutiny. So this is what we're working with, and this is one of the fundamental reflex structures. Part of our conditioning is this structure, that we turn sensation into pleasure by pursuing it in thought. So then he says that then we want to repeat it, but the very projection into the future is doubtful. You may not get it, or you may lose it. So we enter into this fear of fear. So fear arises, is associated inevitably with the continuation of pleasure, as is the pain of losing it or not losing it. When we lose pleasure or the object of pleasure, intimate relationships or our house or anything we depend on for our satisfaction and so on, we go into all kinds of turmoil, right? We suffer. So pleasure, the pursuit of pleasure, is part behind the structure of suffering. And also of conflict, because people will want to maintain their pleasures. Say, the security is part of pleasure. Their status is part of pleasure. He said something extraordinary in one of his chapters at the end there, by saying that pleasure is the structure of society. I never thought of that. So the structure of society is a bunch of buildings with a bunch of functionaries in them. But no, the internal structure of society is pleasure, is a very purpose. It's the pleasure principle of consciousness that creates society, and it builds us, creates, yeah, brings about a society which has that same purpose. The inner and the outer are one and the same. They are the same movement. You and I are humanity, and whatever happens in consciousness, the conditioning of the mind is the structure of society. Our society, as you can see, is bound to pleasure. And he warned that in the future, as the machine takes over and takes over more of the functions of humanity, what is humanity going to do? We are at that verge now because of an artificial intelligence, which he warned against. What's going to happen if the machine takes over lots of the functions of human thought, of human action? What's mankind going to do if they find themselves with a lot of leisure? They're going to go for entertainment, which is happening. What is happening is a lot of mindless entertainment, escapism. So we're going to escape again. Or, he said, they're going to go inward. So this is part of his challenge, I think, and where Krishnamurti has something to say at this juncture in our civilization itself. He's saying you can't go that way. There's only one way to go, given the mechanical takeover, the takeover of the machine. You can only go inward. So know yourself.